Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. If you enjoy these studies from the book of Isaiah, help us get the message out and share them with your friends. Remember to support Beth Emmanuel with your tithes and offerings at BethEmmanuel.org.
It's out of context, clearly.
Yeah.
They're both completely out of context.
Okay, all right.
Both quotations are completely out of context. Okay. Once again, we see the principle, though. This is rabbinic exegesis. We're not working in the Peshat. We're working on a different level of interpretation up in the Midrash. This is the way the rabbis dealt with the text. The rabbis are saying, how does this apply to Moses? Well, it doesn't really, but maybe it's like this. The fortified city isn't Samaria, it's Rome in their day and age, right? Rome is the fortified city. And the calf that lies down, what could be the calf that lies down in the fortified city? Well, that's King Messiah. Just like Moses was raised in Pharaoh's court, and Pharaoh had no idea that the person who was going to ultimately overthrow him was being brought up in his court. That's how it is in Rome right now. The Messiah's in Rome right now, and he's hiding out in Rome, and one day he's going to reveal himself. He's going to overthrow Rome. This is the a common idea about Messiah among the sages, is that he's hanging out in Rome and has been since the destruction of the temple, and is one day is going to reveal himself. All right, so we don't have to think about that any further. It's just a good example of rabbinic use of the text. Let's go on. I'll show you another. Verse 12. New oracle starts in verse 12. In that day, the Lord will start his threshing from the flowing stream of the Euphrates to the brook of the Egypt. All right, that's a way of saying from north to south in the land. We're not talking here when it says from the flowing stream of the Euphrates to the brook of Egypt. We're not talking about the Euphrates up in Mesopotamia and the Nile River. Although we will in the next verse. Instead, these are borders on the land of Israel, where the Euphrates makes an arc in Syria. All right, so that's like the top, utmost border of the land of Israel in several texts. And the Brook of Egypt is a wadi down south of the Negev that is like the borderline between the land of Israel and Egypt. It's called the Brook of Egypt because that's where Egyptian territory would start south of that. All right. So, in other words, in the land of Israel, he says, in that day the Lord will start threshing from the flowing stream of the Euphrates to the brook of Egypt, so in the land of Israel, and you will be gathered up one by one, O sons of Israel. What does this mean? Literally, what does it mean? Literally, I think it's talking about the deportations. You'll be gathered up in the land of Israel, and you're going to be deported. That's what's going to happen in the north. We know that's what's going to happen when the Assyrians come. So I think that's what he's referring to. The sages understood it differently. The sages said, no, this refers to just the opposite. It doesn't refer to the deportation. It refers to the ingathering. Yeah. But wait a second. How can you be ingathered if you're already in the land? If you're already in the land, how can you be ingathered? So the answer is, Delitzsch brings this out, but I'm sure he got it from Jewish sources. It's the resurrection. It's the resurrection of the dead that's being referred to here. Something that's very interesting in this verse is that when it says threshing, it doesn't actually use the word for threshing. It uses a different Hebrew word, the word chabat. So it says, in that day the Lord will chabat, which means beat out. Now, there's only two places that this word is used. To chabat is to use big sticks. They beat, boom, 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 with these big sticks. And use this for threshing certain kinds of grains. In fact, I think we even have, if we were to read on far enough, we would find one of them. Yes, in the next chapter, in chapter 28... It says in verse 27, dill is not threshed with a threshing sledge, nor is a cartwheel driven over cumin. Dill is beaten out, chabat, boom, 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 with a rod, cumin with a club. So that's the word, chabat. The other thing you find Chabad used for, and this is what I like better, is the olive harvest, as it says in Deuteronomy 24:20, when you chabat your olive trees. And what you do to harvest an olive, have you ever seen an olive tree being harvested? It's really cool. Here's what you do. You lay sheets under the tree, these big sheets all around under the tree, then you take these big sticks and you go beat the branches, boom, 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 and the ripe olives just fall, right? And you gather them up. And you pick up the sheets, dump the sheets into your buckets, and that's how they do the olive harvest. Rashi has an explanation on this. He says what it means is the ingathering of exiles will be a difficult feat. It'll be difficult to accomplish. The Almighty will, so to speak, hold every individual Jew's hand and return him to the land of Israel. So that's how he understands it, this to be beaten out, to be Hashem's going to have to pick up each Jew and carry him to the land of Israel. So this is, again, the sages take it as the ingathering. All right, and that's on this. Why do they do that? It's on the strength of the next verse, which is actually a separate oracle. It will come about also in that day that a great trumpet will be blown, and those who are perishing in the land of Assyria and those who are scattered in the land of Egypt, the two big population centers, right? Mesopotamia, Egypt, will come and worship the Lord in the holy mountain at Jerusalem. Now this definitely is a prophecy of the ingathering. A great shofar, it says a great shofar is going to be blown. And the sound of this shofar is the shofar of the resurrection. It's the shofar of Messiah. And it's the shofar of the ingathering, what the Christians call the rapture. This shofar blows. Well, you know why it's called the great shofar? Well, yeah, it's also called the last shofar. Why is it called the great shofar? Because it's louder than what?
It gets louder.
Oh, because it gets louder. No, you're on the right track. Because there's another important shofar in the Bible. And that's the one that blew at Mount Sinai. So there's two shofars, two big shofars. The one that God blew at Mount Sinai, and the one he's going to blow at the ingathering, at the time of the coming of Messiah and the resurrection of the dead. Shofars are ram's horns, you know? And so the explanation is that Abraham caught this ram. It got caught by its shofars, right? By its horns. Abraham offered this ram as a burnt offering in the place of his son Isaac, but one of the horns was slightly larger than the other horn. So yeah. God took the two horns and he blew the first horn at Mount Sinai, and he's saving the second horn to blow at the time of the coming of the Messiah. These are the horns of Isaac's ram, the shofars. That's the explanation. It's a very old explanation. It goes all the way back to find that in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. That's why it's called the great shofar. As you can read Gadol, shofar Gadol, you could just read that as the bigger, or the big shofar. Okay? The big shofar. And of course, this connects to the resurrection of the dead. For example, find a parallel passage in Isaiah 18, verse 3, where it says, "All you inhabitants of the world and dwellers on earth, as soon as the standard is raised in the mountains, you'll see it. As soon as the shofar is blown, you will hear it." This is one of the proof texts that the rabbis use regarding the resurrection of the dead. Inhabitants of the world and dwellers on earth. Why is it? What's the difference between inhabitant of the world and dweller on earth? Well, one is alive and the other is dead. One is alive and the other is in the... One's on earth, the other's in the earth. that's how the rabbis read it. So it's one of the proof texts that they use for the resurrection of the dead. The idea of the resurrection being connected with the blast of a shofar. Which is something you see in the New Testament. Let's go straight to Isaiah chapter 27. We're going to be learning chapter 27, chapter 28, chapter 29 tonight of Isaiah. It's a lot of material, once again, but that's how we're going to get this class done in 12 weeks, is by taking on a lot of material every night. So I have some, see where it says my notes? I didn't actually intend for you to have my notes. But I just accidentally printed like 23 copies anyway. So I thought, well, that's easy. It's like a bonus. Yeah. No, this is actually just the introduction to this Haftarah portion. It's not a Haftarah portion, but Isaiah chapter 27 and 28 are Haftarat Yitro. What does that mean? It means it's the reading from the prophets. Did I say Yitro?
Yeah.
I meant Shemot.
Yeah.
It's the reading from the prophets for the first couple chapters of Exodus. So when we get to the Shabbat Shemot, where we read Exodus chapter 1 through chapter 6 or so, the Haftarah portion, the reading from the prophets that you hear in the synagogue, is Isaiah chapter 27, verse 6 through 28, verse 13. And because of that, I've written on this particular passage before, in Torah Club 3, which deals with each of the Haftarah portions. And so this is the introduction to the historical context of the Haftarah portion and fit just perfectly. All right, so we're just going to read through this very quickly. Isaiah the prophet was a Jerusalem Judean, but he predicted and witnessed the fall of Samaria and the deportation of the northern kingdom of Israel. Some themes we've been learning in this class. The oracle in this week's Haftarah portion may derive from different periods of the prophet's life, but they best fit the earliest years of King Hezekiah prior to the fall of Samaria in 722 BC. So we're actually going backwards in time as we've moved forward in the book of Isaiah. Because last week, you remember, we were later in Hezekiah's life, we were preparing Judah for an Assyrian invasion, which came, you know, several decades later. So now we're going back prior to the final fall of the northern kingdom of Israel. The Assyrians had already begun to molest the northern tribes. In 734 BC, Tiglath-Pileser III deposed Israel's king, Pekah, took thousands of captives into exile, and forced the nation into vassalage. In this week's Haftarah portion, and it's not this week's Haftarah portion, realize, but I'm just reading you as if it was. Isaiah predicts that the worst is yet to come. He foresees Samaria deserted like an abandoned homestead, and he pronounces woe upon the proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim. Despite his pronouncements against the northern kingdom, Isaiah was actually more concerned with affairs in Judah. King Ahaz, remember that's Uzziah's son, had appealed to the Assyrians for help. Tiglath-Pileser sent his forces to Ahaz, but the alliance did not work out well. 2 Chronicles 28:20 says, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came against him and afflicted him instead of strengthening him. Remember back to that whole conversation with Ahaz. It says, ask for a sign, anything, name it, in heaven, on earth. Just don't do this thing with the Assyrians. And he said, I'm not interested in a sign. We learned that several weeks ago. So it didn't work out for Ahaz. Ahaz paid tribute to Assyria, and Judah became a vassal. When Hezekiah took the throne, the kingdom was still under Assyrian power, thanks to Ahaz. At the beginning of his tenure, Hezekiah found the priesthood in disarray. The temple had been closed up by his father Ahaz. The priests were no longer conscientious about matters of ritual purity. In this Haftarah portion, Isaiah brings harsh rebukes against the priests and the prophets of Jerusalem. Hezekiah tried to reverse the mischief his father had created for Judah. He led a massive reform, reconstituted the Levitical worship system, campaigned against apostasy. He also wanted to escape Assyrian control, which is what we studied last week. He and the leadership of Judah looked to Egypt for political and military alliance. And that's what we're going to look at this week. In this Haftarah, Isaiah rebukes the Judean leadership for spiritual insobriety and political alliances with foreign powers. There you go. I've got more on the printer out there, just in case. All right, so that's our introduction. That gives you the historical context to what we're going to be reading tonight. Now we better get reading it really quickly. Go to Isaiah chapter 27. I know I already told you to do that. All right, Isaiah chapter 27. And we're going to start in verse 6 of the chapter. In the days to come, this is where the Haftarah portion starts, if it was Parshat Shemot. In the days to come, Jacob will take root. Israel will blossom and sprout. And they will fill the whole world with fruit. And that's the reason it's the Haftarah portion. Because the beginning of the book of Exodus begins with several statements about how the children of Israel sprouted, blossomed, bore fruit, were very fruitful and multiplied in the land of Egypt. And so that's your connection to the Torah portion, if we were studying it as a Haftarah. We start a new oracle in verse 7. Like the striking of him who has struck them, has he struck them? Or like the slaughter of his slain, have they been slain? You contended with them by banishing them, by driving them away. With his fierce wind, he has expelled them on the day of the east wind. Therefore, through this, Jacob's iniquity will be forgiven, and this will be the full price of the pardoning of his sin. When he makes all the altar stones like pulverized chalk stones, when the asherim and the incense altars will not stand. So what's going on here? Isaiah is prophesying about the north. He's prophesying about Samaria and the tribes of Ephraim, the northern coalition, however you want to say that, Israel up there in the north. He's prophesying that they are going to be driven into exile. Hashem's going to scatter them. He's going to drive them out of their land, and they're going to pay for their sins in this manner, in this time of exile. What's worse, now he's going to talk about what's going to happen to their capital city. For the fortified city is isolated, a homestead forlorn and forsaken like the desert. There the calf will graze, and there it will lie down and feed on its branches. When its limbs are dry, they are broken off. Women come and make fire with them. They are not a people of discernment. Therefore, their Maker will not have compassion on them. Their Creator will not be gracious to them. This is great stuff. It really fits in the land of Israel. This is the kind of passage my brother likes to take and unpack when he gets us out there in the land of Israel. He's talking about you've got a fortified city, it's got its gardens, it's got its vineyards, it's got its, you know, its agriculture going on. But in the future, what's going to happen is the walls are going to be destroyed and shepherds are going to be bringing their livestock into the city. The city's going to be overgrown. It's a picture of destruction, of devastation. What was once a city is now just like a field. Women are coming and breaking off branches and using that for their cooking fires. And there's a cow laying down here. Do you see that? The calf will graze, and there it will lie down and feed on the branches. It's an interesting thing that we need to talk about as we're studying this. And I was almost afraid to do this as I was thinking about how to teach this material tonight. Because there's a great danger of just talking really fast and confusing you. And I'm afraid I do that sometimes. So, here's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to talk really fast and not confuse you. I've got three interpretations of Isaiah that I need to bring to you tonight simultaneously. Okay. One is the literal historical interpretation. That's what I'm teaching you right now about. What does this really mean in its context to Isaiah? What is Isaiah talking about? And what does he expect that people understand he's talking about? Okay, that's literal historical context. The second is the rabbinic reading. The rabbis are not reading this according to literal historical context. Although they know that, that's called Peshat, that's the lower level. They're not interested in that. Because instead they're reading it as the Haftarah portion for Parshat Shemot. So they want to know, what does this teach us about Parshat Shemot? What does this teach us about the first six chapters of Exodus? Right? That's what they're interested in. Okay, so that's the second level of interpretation we're going to be looking at, or the second interpretation. The third interpretation we're looking at is whatever the apostles end up doing with all this material. which might be some of the some of both of those, and then something else as well. First six chapters of Exodus, Parshat Shemot. Oh, what happens in those first six chapters? When you think about it, at the beginning of the book of Exodus, the main story of the beginning of the book of Exodus is the birth of Moses. Well, there's the babies getting thrown into the Nile River and all that sort of thing. Then there's the birth of Moses, midwife spare his life, baby Moses in the basket. Then Moses grows up, Moses goes to Midian, escapes Egypt, goes to Midian, Moses and the burning bush. Moses goes back to Egypt, says, let my people go. Pharaoh says, no, you're lazy, that's why you want the people to go, and now you go make bricks without straw. There you go. Parsha in a nutshell. We're reading this and we're saying, now how does this relate to our Torah portion? And we just read this passage. It says, the fortified city is isolated, a homestead forlorn and forsaken like a desert. There the calf will graze. There it will lie down and feed on its branches. So here's how the rabbis read this. You see this in Exodus Rabbah on your sheet under the heading that says the Great Shofar. In the very small 8-point italic type. Can you see that? Because I can't. Yeah, it's very dark in here. That's what it is. Also, forgot my glasses at home. And usually I have 6 pairs in my office, but they've all migrated home in different pockets of my coats. And yeah. Anyway, doesn't matter. I know the shapes of the words. Chapter 28 begins what is called Isaiah's Book of Woes. Woe. You know what woe is? You know, woe. Do you have sorrow? Do you have woe? Do you have troubles? Yes. Woe. Woe is the opposite of ashrei. So, you know, ashrei? You know, ashrei. Happy, contented, joy. Oh, contentment awaits. Woe is the Hebrew word oi. Oi. Feels like it sounds. In Norwegian, you say ufta. Yeah. So if Isaiah had been a Norwegian prophet instead of a Jewish prophet, he would have said ufta to the proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim, right? You ever hear that? Ufta? I grew up in Minnesota. Yeah. That's Norwegian. It's Norwegian. That's not Swedish. No. Swedish say other things that are unpronounceable. Woe to the proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim. See, remember, we're still prophesying against the north and what's coming down on the north. And to the fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is at the head of the fertile valley, of those who are overcome with wine. He's speaking about the leadership and the prophets of and the kings and the officials of Israel in the north. When he makes reference to this fading flower of its glorious beauty, he's going to show you a connection to this in Isaiah 4, which makes direct reference to King Messiah. I'll read on a little bit and then we'll go look at that. Behold, the Lord has a strong and mighty agent, as a storm of hail, a tempest of destruction, like a storm of mighty overflowing waters. He has cast it down to the earth with his hand. The proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim is trodden underfoot. The fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is at the head of the fertile valley. It will be like the first ripe fig prior to summer, which one sees. And as soon as it is in his hand, he swallows it. It's that idea of you're walking along and you see the fig tree and you know, you see the, like, oh, a ripe, there's a ripe one. And just like grab it and wolf it down. Yeah. Whoop. Says that's what it's going to be like for Samaria from the north. So he's going to show you a parallel to this kind of language. So you know what exactly what he's talking about. You know the symbolism he's using. We find in Isaiah chapter 4 regarding the kingdom. Verse 2 says, in that day the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious. Just like that flower that's going to be that once beautiful and glorious flower. And the fruit of the earth will be the pride and adornment of the survivors of Israel. Same language. So here we're talking about the king of Israel, the king of the north. He's the fig that's going to be swallowed. Verse 6, of chapter 28, a spirit of justice for him who sits in judgment, a strength to those who repel the onslaught at the gate, and these also reel with wine and stagger from strong drink. The priest and the prophet reel with strong drink. They are confused by wine. They stagger from strong drink. Imagine, I'm going to try to set this up for you. Let me make up context. Imagine we're in Jerusalem. I'm the prophet Isaiah, all right? And you guys are the priests and prophets and counselors and officials of Judah, the important religious people, the religious establishment, Hezekiah's administrators, the elders, and this sort of thing. And I'm here, you call me in because I'm the prophet. And prophets, you prophesy? I'm going to give you some prophecy. Okay. Woe to Ephraim! Woe to Samaria! I'm going to give them some woes and that sort of thing. Oh, it's going to be bad for them. And you're all going, oh, it's going to be bad for them, right? Not for us so much, right? Okay, but then all of a sudden I turn on you, and in verse 7, because I was just condemning the drunkards of Ephraim, meaning the leadership of Ephraim, and all of a sudden I turn on you in verse 7 and say, and these also... And now I'm talking about you. These also reel with wine and stagger from strong drink. The priests and the prophets reel with strong drink. They are confused by wine. They stagger from strong drink. They reel while having visions. They totter when rendering judgment. All the tables are full of filthy vomit without a single clean place. All right. So I really give it, right? Pirkei Avot pulls out this passage. And we like to cite it a little bit. Rabbi Shimon said, if three men sit at the table together but do not speak any words of Torah, it's as if they've eaten sacrifice offered to the idols, a table of idolaters. Regarding such people, it is said, for all the tables are full of filthy vomit without a single clean place. All right, that's out of context, but that's where the passage comes from. The Almighty said, the Almighty is not with them. But if they have spoken some words of Torah between them when they sat down to eat at the table, it's as if they have eaten at the table of God. Blessed is he, as it is said, this is the table that is before the Lord. It's Pirkei Avot. It's just a nice passage. Okay, so you guys are mad now, aren't you? Because I just called you a bunch of drunkards and said your table's full of filthy vomit. Right? I mean, that's like a little, that's offensive. And you probably actually are having a few while this is going on, And so now you're going to respond. And you respond in verse 9. To whom would he teach knowledge? To whom would he interpret the message? Those just weaned from milk? Those just taken from the breast? For he says, order on order, line on line, a little here, a little there. All right, so this is your response. This is how I understand the passage. My brother and I have worked really hard on this passage, trying to come to terms with what's going on here. This is you guys making fun of Isaiah. You're saying, what does he think, we're babies? He's treating us like children with this kind of talk? And what's really interesting... is this line on line, order on order. I think our translators have made a big mistake by translating this. It's not supposed to be translated. These aren't words. These are sounds. You can construe them to be words because Hebrew works like that. You can pretty much make a word out of any two letters in Hebrew and figure out. But I don't believe that they're supposed to be words. Instead, listen to what it sounds like in Hebrew. Tzav letzav, tzav letzav, kav lekav, zer sham, zer sham. It's blah, 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 blah,
blah, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. That's what it is. It's blah, 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 blah. Or, yeah, that's what it's supposed to be. Or some, possibly it's alphabet practice. Because Kav, excuse me, Kov comes after the Sadi. So it's possible that this is like elemental P.
Yeah.
You know, like when you're learning your alphabet, elemental P. It's a sequence of the letters.
Yeah.
And so it's just like, so it's like a nursery rhyme type of sing-song sequence. Who do you think you're talking to? Babies that have just been weaned from the breast? Blah, 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 blah. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. You know, like that. That's the implication. The sages are looking at this and they're saying, well, what does this have to do with Moses? Right? What about the story of Moses? Well, there's a story. There's a story here. The first story, when he says, to whom would he teach knowledge? To those to whom would he interpret those just weaned from milk? Turns out that Pharaoh's daughter, when she took this baby Moses, she said, I'm going to have this baby. And she tried to find a wet nurse. She brings all these different Egyptian women who are nursing babies at the time, you know, and but Moses will have not what to do with them, right? Because God had said, shall the mouth that will one day speak with me drink from an unclean vessel? And this is the meaning of Isaiah 28 when it says, to whom would he teach knowledge? To those whom, to whom he would interpret the message, those just weaned from milk, those just weaned, those just taken from the breast. So Miriam says, shall I go get a Hebrew woman to nurse him? And then she goes and gets Yocheved. And that, so this is sort of a story stuck into the text by the sages to connect with this. Kind of an amusing anecdote about baby Moses. Really has nothing at all to do with what's going on here in Isaiah, does it? No. But it's an amusing story about Moses. And people probably knew it, even in the days of the apostles. Probably knew that story. It's just, it's an old popular story. There's another one that goes with the stuttering part. Why did Moses stutter? You know why Moses had a stutter? This is another famous story, comes from the same stuff, same passages. Here's why Moses had a stutter. Once it happened that baby Moses took Pharaoh's crown and placed it on his own head. Pharaoh's magicians and advisors said, perhaps he is destined to take the kingdom away from you. It could be a sign, you know. Some counseled Pharaoh to execute the baby with a sword, others with fire. But one wise man objected and said, yeah, the child has no understanding. Test him. Set before him a plate containing gold and a plate with two live coals. If he reaches for the gold, then he has understanding. Then we know he purposely took the crown as a sign that he's going to take your kingdom. And you should kill him. But if he reaches for the live coals, then we know he has no understanding and he doesn't deserve to be put to death. They did so. What did Moses do? He reached for the gold, right? But the angel Gabriel came and moved his hand, causing him to snatch up one of the live coals instead of the gold. He puts the live coal to his mouth, and he burns his lips and his tongue, saves his life, but ever since then, he's a man of slow speech with a speech impediment. You know, babies, they put everything in their mouth. It's the first thing they do. It's like, pick it up, put it in your mouth. Well, what does this text have to do with our text in Isaiah? It doesn't actually quote the text in Isaiah, but we're talking about the speech impediment,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about Tzav L'Tzav, Tzav L'Tzav, Kav L'Kav, Kav L'Kav. And as we read on, here's the answer. Isaiah replies now to this mocking. He says, indeed, he will speak to this people. You know, God will speak to this people. Through stuttering lips, like Moses, and a foreign tongue. In other words, what Isaiah is talking about is Aramaic. People don't know Aramaic at this time. They only know Hebrew. And he says, through a foreign language, the language of the Assyrians, the Aramaic of the Assyrians, is how he's going to speak to you when you're carried away into exile. He who said to them, here is rest, give rest to the weary, and here is repose, but they would not listen. So the word of the Lord will be to them, Tzav L'Tzav, Kav L'Kav. And he gives us the same thing. Blah, 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 blah. Because that's what it'll sound like when the Assyrians are speaking to you. That they may go and stumble backward, be broken, snared, and taken captive. Which is reference to being slain in the spirit. Not really. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, O scoffers. See, you were just making fun of me, scoffers. Who rule this people who are in Jerusalem. Because you have said, we have made a covenant with death. With Sheol, we have made a pact. The overwhelming scourge will not reach us when it passes by. For we have made falsehood our refuge. We have concealed ourselves with deception. What are they talking? What's going on? What's this covenant with death? This pact with Sheol? This is Egypt. You guys have made an alliance with Egypt. You think that when Assyria comes, it's not going to touch you. You're not, because Egypt will be there to protect you from the overwhelming scourge, which is the Assyrian invasion that's coming. You think that that it will just pass you by because of your covenant with Egypt, which is a covenant with death, with Sheol, which is with falsehood and with deception. These are all terms he's using for Egypt. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a costly cornerstone for the foundation, firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed. I will make justice the measuring line, righteousness the level. Then hail will sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters will overflow the secret place. So your alliance with Egypt won't stand. Your covenant with death will be canceled. Your pact with Sheol will not stand. When the overwhelming scourge passes through, that's Assyria, then you become its trampling place. As often as it passes through, it will seize you. The Assyrians are going to prevail against you, in other words. Morning after morning, it will pass through. Any time during the day and night, it will be sheer terror to understand what it means. The bed is too short to stretch out. The blanket too small to wrap oneself in. That's great poetry. For the Lord will rise up at Mount Perazim, stirred in the valley of Gibeon, to do his task, his unusual task, his extraordinary work. And now, do not carry on as scoffers, or your fetters will be made stronger. For I've heard from the Lord God of hosts of decisive destruction of the earth. All right, it's a really powerful passage that he comes back at them with after this baby talk, scoffing. Essentially what he's saying here is, you've made a pact with Egypt, and you think that that's going to protect you from Assyria. It won't. But I'll tell you what will. I'm going to lay in Zion a king. This is my cornerstone. I'm going to put my cornerstone in Zion that will survive this overwhelming scourge. And of course, this is going to be King Hezekiah. This verse 16 here. Therefore, the Lord God says, I'm laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone. I'm saying this is Hezekiah that Isaiah has in mind here. Yet, it's not just Hezekiah, it's the Messiah. Because remember, Hezekiah is a candidate to be the Messiah. Turns out he's not. The prophecy still stands. The prophecy is going to apply to Messiah in the future then. But here's how Targum Yonatan translates it. What's Targum Yonatan? Well, you know who Hillel was? Hillel and Shammai. So Hillel's a teacher, a rabbi in the days of Yeshua, actually about one generation before Yeshua, but they crossed paths. Hillel would have been one of the sages at the temple when Yeshua was there when he was 12 years old, right? So Hillel has a disciple named Yonatan ben Uziel. Yonatan ben Uziel is really good at Aramaic and Hebrew. So Hillel has him write a translation of the prophets into Aramaic. How does he translate this verse? I will lay in Zion a stone. This is how he understood it. So what's nice about Targum Yonatan is it gives us a first century read how the prophecies were understood, specifically Isaiah. Behold, I appoint a king in Zion, a mighty, powerful, terrible king, and I will make him powerful, and I will strengthen him, saith the prophet. But the righteous who believe these things shall not be moved when distress shall come. I love that translation. Oh. That's the gist of it. He unpacks the symbolism for you. I'd like you to note on your sheet that I've given you another passage to compare, a couple of passages to compare from Isaiah 8. We're not going to do that now. Running out of time. All right, so you can see that this is something that's come up before. This prophecy has come up before. We're going to skip ahead to chapter 29. Oi! Oh, Ariel, Ariel. City where David once camped. So what's Ariel? Ariel is the Hebrew word for lioness. So he's calling the city a lioness. He's saying, oi, lioness, lioness, the city where David once camped. Add year to year. Observe your feasts on schedule. Which is what we do here, right? I will bring distress to Ariel, to the lioness. She will be a city of lamentation and mourning. She will be like an Ariel to me. I will camp against you, encircling you. Oh, it's a siege. The siege of Jerusalem. I will set siege works against you. I will raise up battle towers against you. Then you will be brought low. From the earth you will speak. From the dust where you are prostrate, your words will come. Your words will be like that of us. Your speech will whisper from the dust. But the multitude of your enemies will become like fine dust. The multitude of the ruthless ones, like the chaff which blows away. It will happen instantly, suddenly. From the Lord of hosts you will be punished with thunder and earthquake, loud noise, whirlwind, tempest, flame, consuming fire. And the multitude of nations who wage war against Ariel, all who wage war against her and her household, and who distress her, will be like a dream, a vision of the night. Let's just make sure you're following the story of this siege. Jerusalem is under siege. Siege works have been laid up against her. Jerusalem is going to be so, the Judah and the people of Jerusalem are going to be so wiped out that it's almost like they're a spirit, you know, crawling up from the ground. There's so few left. They're so afflicted, so oppressed, so devastated. But then, just when it seems like we're at the end, that things can't possibly get any worse, what happens? It's like you wake up in the morning and the enemy is gone. It was all a bad dream. It was a bad dream. You know, the sun is shining, the birds are singing. It says it will be like when a hungry man dreams and behold, he's eating. But then he wakes up and his hunger is not satisfied. Or as when a thirsty man dreams and behold, he is drinking. But when he awakens, behold, he is faint and his thirst is not quenched. Thus the multitude of all the nations who wage war against Mount Zion. So we have here a prophecy about this overwhelming scourge that's going to come, that's starting to turn around. We're starting to see the light at the end of the prophetic tunnel, so to speak. And these prophecies then refer to the Assyrian invasion that Isaiah has been predicting. They also refer to Gog and Magog. The Assyrian invasion that Isaiah has been predicting is like little Gog and Magog. Be delayed and wait. Blind yourselves and be blind. They become drunk, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. For the Lord has poured over you a spirit of deep sleep. He has shut the eyes of your prophets. He has covered your heads with the heads of your seers. The entire vision will be to you like the words of a sealed book, which when they give it to the one who is literate, they'll give it to one who is literate, saying, please read this. He'll say, I cannot. It's sealed. It's a sealed scroll. Okay, so it's, you know, we don't have books in the days of Isaiah. It's not. So it's a scroll with a seal on it. So he says, I can't, it's sealed. So they'll give the book to one who is illiterate, saying, please read this. He says, I can't even read. You know? And then the Lord, so what is this referring to? I'm not even sure. It's sealed. Then the Lord said, because this people draw near with their words and honor me with their lip service, but they remove their hearts far from me. Their reverence for me consists of tradition learned by rote. That's an anti-Semitic translation. In my opinion, it should say their reverence consists of a commandment learned, you know, which is similar. But why would you translate mitzvah as tradition here? I don't know. There's probably a good reason. I didn't look into it. Therefore, behold, I will once again deal marvelously with this people, wondrously marvelous, and the wisdom of their wise men will perish. The discernment of their discerning men will be concealed. Woe to those who deeply hide their plans from the Lord, and whose deeds are done in the dark, and they say, who sees us? Who knows? You turn things around. Shall the potter be considered as equal with the clay? That what is made would say to its maker, he did not make me. Or what is formed, should it say to him who formed it, he has no understanding. And then he goes on with a beautiful prophecy about the kingdom. About the kingdom of heaven and how things are going to be great in the kingdom. And we're not going to read it because we're out of time. That's as far as we got. All right. Can we do the New Testament? How does the New Testament understand these passages? It's really fascinating. Actually, there's a lot of... this is going all over the place. But start with the great shofar. Start with that great shofar. It's obvious. Isn't that obvious? Now when you think... because what does Yeshua say? The Master says, in that day, there will be a great shofar. A great shofar will be blown. And the Son of Man will appear with his Father's angels, and they will gather the elect from the four winds, or from the four corners of the earth. It's Matthew 24. It's not even being used out of context. That's exactly what it says in Isaiah. He just ties it to the revelation of Messiah. It says, what Isaiah is speaking about there is the coming of Messiah. So that's we're going to find the same thing then is repeated in 1 Thessalonians, but tied with the resurrection of the dead as well, which is we saw that in Isaiah. And in 1 Corinthians 15, tied with the resurrection of the dead. And then there's also the trumpets of Revelation. We come up to, you know, the same thing. It's not different trumpet. It's the same thing. I'm really, the one that intrigues me the most is the way that this one works in. Go to 1 Corinthians 14. Actually, we're talking about the gifts of the Spirit at third meal on Sabbath afternoons, right? For those of you who are able to come to that, we're talking, so this is a passage that we will be looking at in that context as well. This is 1 Corinthians chapter 14, where Paul is actually speaking about the gift of tongues. Earlier on, he's saying, you know, look, if somebody's speaking in tongues, nobody understands them. You need an interpreter because nobody understands them. If they're speaking in a language and in a language that nobody understands, you need an interpreter. And he says, you know, otherwise, if you don't have, I would rather have, you know, people speak in languages that can be understood. Otherwise, nobody knows when to say amen. That's what he says right here, right? And he says in verse 17, and he says, for you are giving thanks well enough, but the other person is not edified if you're speaking in a tongue. I thank God I speak in tongues more than all of you. However, in the church, I desire to speak 5 words with my mind so that I can instruct others also than 10,000 words in a tongue. So clearly, when he's talking about tongues in this passage, he's not talking about known human languages, in my opinion anyway. These are prayer language, or what's called prayer language. You know, it's this charismatic phenomenon that Baptists don't do, and I don't either. But people from some of these backgrounds do. My point is, you know, whether you accept it as genuine or not is really irrelevant. The fact is that it was happening in the first century, and it wasn't just happening in Judaism. You know, it was happening in the pagan world as well. This oracles through ecstatic utterances was the normal mode of prophetic communication in the first century Roman world. Okay. So it's not surprising that it's happening in Corinth among the Corinthian believers. So Paul's saying, you know, I'm just not so hot on it. I would prefer, you know, to speak 5 words that make sense. And then he goes on. He says, brethren, don't be infants in your thinking. Don't be children in your thinking. In regard to evil, be infants, but in your thinking, be mature. In the law, it's written, by men of strange tongues and the lips of strangers, I will speak to this people, and even so, they will not listen to me, says the Lord. So he quotes our passage from Isaiah. Now, what's interesting is, like, remember the passage from Isaiah? It was something about stammering lips and stuttering, and I said that's in regard to the Aramaic of the Assyrians. But it's also right in connection with this passage
Tzav l'tzav, kav l'kav. Right? Tzav l'tzav, kav l'kav. Zer yisham, which is gibberish.
Paul's just talking about praying in gibberish and saying, look, yeah. I'd rather speak five words that are a real language than 10,000 words of gibberish. And then he cites a passage from Isaiah that's right next to a line of gibberish. It wouldn't have worked if you tried it, because Paul's writing in Greek, so it really wouldn't have worked to cite the next the next line. You know, it doesn't work in translation. I absolutely am convinced that the phenomenon he's hearing in Corinth as ecstatic languages or ecstatic tongues, prayer language, reminds him of this passage from Isaiah, because it sounds like that. Blah, 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 blah. It's not a real language. And so he says, that's why he quotes this. Don't be children. Be mature in your thinking about this. Stone of testing. Well, this is Messiah. We can look at several of these passages. You can look at several of these passages. This, behold, I lay in Zion, an Evan Bohar, a tested stone. This is a centerpiece of Messianic Midrash among the apostles. So we have quotations in Romans 9, Yeshua even quotes it or alludes to it in Matthew 21. Yeshua connects it brilliantly with this cornerstone. He connects with the cornerstone the builders rejected, or the stone the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. He makes a midrash. He links those together in Matthew chapter 21. Peter picks that up in 1 Peter 2, and he quotes this passage and three other stone passages, or two other stone passages. Puts them. We already looked at this a couple weeks ago, so we don't have to read it now. But there it is on your sheet, and I even put in the references for you. What was offensive when he quoted this passage was the implication that he is the discarded stone, that they've discarded him, but he will be the chief cornerstone. So he's saying, it's really a declaration that I am the Messiah, son of David. There's a whole story behind this. Maybe we'll pick this up next week, and we got through stammering lips. We'll pick up the rest of them next week and see if we can squeeze those in at the beginning of the lecture next week.